I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. If you've lived in this part of the world or followed Canadian politics over the last 30 years or more, there isn't a political figure either loved or loathed as much as former NDP MP Sven Robinson. From his first election to the House of Commons in 1979 to his public downfall after the theft of a diamond ring in 2004 that essentially ended his political career, Robinson was a very public figure, garnering attention from the press like nobody before or since. He used the press effectively to get attention for causes that were important to him. While there were many opponents, from his own side of the political aisle, who didn't share his public zeal, he was Canada's first openly gay MP. He was imprisoned for blocking loggers from clear-cutting Clackwat Sound. He protested for human rights, getting injured, and even getting expelled from foreign countries. A new book, Sven Robinson, A Life in Politics, looks at this remarkable life, the early years with difficulties within his family, his years of service, and in the public eye, his diagnosis with bipolar disorder, and his life today. The book's author joins me now. Graham Truelove is an author, editor, and proofreader. He has worked for the House of Commons and the Library of Parliament since 2001 and was an intern in Robinson's Ottawa office from 2002 to 2004. He's also taught at Frontier College. The website for more is at grahamtruelove.com. The book is published by New Star Books. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Ottawa today, Graham Truelove. Mr. Truelove, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I enjoyed this book a great deal because, as I told you before we started taping, I got a great sense that you worked to give us the context of the times that Sven Robinson lived in and the things that over his career he encountered. Was it a fun book to write? I know this is your first book.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a fun book to write. It touched on so many different areas of policy. He was involved in so much, so I got to go behind the scenes on pretty well all of the big activist causes over the last 25 and 30 years. So to me, it was like a survey course in Canadian progressive politics.
And you also say in the acknowledgments that a biographer never had it so good. So you got access to him, his partner Max, as well as his papers over the years. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. He actually, he's a bit of a pack rat, so he'd saved, piles and piles of his own correspondence and notes, even some diaries and things like that. So he actually, in cooperating on this biography, not only gave me access to interviews and to family and friends and former colleagues, but also to the material that he'd saved himself, and that was, I think unparalleled access.
Yeah, did he have a say in what's in the book, or perhaps what's not in here?
No, I did show him a version of it, and there were a couple of areas with respect to his family that he said, do we really need to go there? Is that really germane to the story? Out of respect, I decided not to go there. I think that when you're related to somebody who's chosen to have a public life, that's not necessarily your choice. And so, if it wasn't, as I said, germane to the story, I was more than willing to be respectful of that distance.
There was a lot of stuff that did happen in his childhood, though, that did shape his life and who he is today, even, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and you have to go there to that extent because, we're all children of our environments, and Sven's formative years were very dramatic, and you can certainly see the impact of them on the man that he would become and the career that he would have. So I think that the struggles of his childhood were absolutely relevant and necessary.
Yeah, talking about what you talk about in the book, and as much as you have talked about in the book, it wasn't a good childhood, right?
No, it was not an easy childhood at all. You've got alcoholism on the father's side. You've got some abuse, a total lack of stability, moving from town to town, country to country, even. It would have been a very rootless sort of feeling for a child.
He was born in the States, is that correct?
That's right. He was born in the States, lived in multiple states, moved back and forth from Canada into the United States, even spent a portion of his childhood in Denmark, went to school in Denmark, learned Danish, then before too long back in the United States again, and only moved permanently to Canada at the age of 14.
So it was your idea to write this book, right? I mean, he didn't come to you and say, I think it's time that my life be looked at critically. This was your idea.
Yeah, it was my idea. You've got this extremely prominent, effective, and unique political character with a painful and dramatic personal life, and yet his full story still hadn't been told. I felt that there was a bit of a gap in our Canadian political archives that I wanted to fill.
Yeah, and if one has followed politics, say, the last 15 years or so and gotten just a look at the press that he got, especially from something like the National Post, it's a very different view than what his life actually is, right, or who he is.
Well, that was another reason to write the book, I think, because he was such a polarizing figure, you've got people who really just worship him, and then you've got other people in whom he provoked a almost visceral hatred like few other politicians, right?
Yeah.
So you really need, I think, a nuanced study of who he really was and what his real impact was, and that's what I tried to provide.
Yeah. And in terms of what drove him to politics and making, say, a difference in the certain issues that he championed over the years, was there something from his past that perhaps provoked this life in politics, as you write in the book?
Well, I think that because of the injustices he faced himself growing up, I think that gave him a high degree of sensitivity towards injustices faced by others. I think as well part of it is the political upbringing that he had. Apart from the turbulent relationship he had with his parents, they were also, you know, very engaged politically and would have exposed him to social activist ideas from a very early age, and he, you know, took very easily to it.
Yeah, when they moved to British Columbia, I guess the part of Burnaby where they lived in, the Capitol Hill area, mm-hmm. What was it known as? Red Hill or something like that?
Because yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And even at an early age when he was a student at UBC, he was very interested in politics. He appeared on a panel with Pierre Trudeau and was quite critical of him. And
yeah,
he got a lot of press for that, didn't he?
Mm-hmm, he did. He was not afflicted with Trudeau-mania in any sense.
Yeah.
He was always highly critical of Trudeau, and driven, you know, to the left right from the beginning of his student activist days. And yeah, that's right. He was pretty well known as a student advocate even before he became nominated as an NDP candidate, which he did at age 25. So by a quite early age, he was a known entity.
He was always the one thing that people remember him about was his high media profile. He was always media savvy, he knew that if he had to put a certain issue on the table, he knew he had to manipulate the press to the point that it did make the nightly news. And you know, from a journalistic point of view, he made great copy all the time. This part of his life, the media savvy part of it, I mean, he knew that early on, didn't he?
Yeah, what I did is I uncovered one of his sort of forgotten political episodes in which, from what I could tell, is the first time he really hit on that idea, this idea that some sort of dramatic action can stimulate media coverage, which can stimulate a public outcry and then change. And that was, it was a case of a Chilean refugee about to be deported back to Augusto Pinochet's Chile. and Sven offers him sanctuary in his home, and this was, you know, a pretty dramatic action when the RCMP are about to activate a deportation order. Mm-hmm. And so in the end, there is this public outcry. People are sympathetic to this guy's cause, and the minister agrees to allow him to stay. So that had a profound impact on him, because Sven felt that he played a part in saving this guy's life. And you see that pattern, that sort of media as a tool, reappear throughout his career.
The other thing that in reading the book that's quite fascinating, like I'm 31, so I've really only known Robinson firsthand, say from the media coverage I've read of him in the last 10 years of his 25 years on Parliament Hill as an MP. We forget early on that the attitudes about gays weren't as accepting as they are today, obviously, and that there was a lot of nastiness that Robinson encountered, even when he wasn't out yet.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty stunning when you go back into the Hansard transcripts of the early 80s and read what was apparently acceptable to say. It's quite shocking, and I think the fact that that is no longer acceptable is in large part due to Robinson's courage in coming out and his constant advocacy since then.
Now, there was a lot of nastiness, a lot of threats even to his life. Did you get the sense from talking to him and looking back at, say, his life, that this stuff hurt him?
Yeah, sure. It was really hurtful. What struck me as the strangest, though, was how he kept exposing himself to it. You know, he read all the hate mail that he got, and that astounds me, because I mean there were truckloads of it, and I've gone through and I've read some of it myself in the course of researching this book, and it's not easy to read that stuff, and yet he did, and I'm sure that had an impact. You know, at the same time, though, by reading all of the mail that he got, he came across some really touching letters from people who said, you know, no, you're doing the right thing. You're representing me. Keep going. We need you. And those had an impact on him, too. And that was one of the things that kept spurring him on, I think.
Yeah, that's the sense that you get, that the good and the bad motivated him in equal measure.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, the other thing that in terms of politics and the politics of who he was, there's a lot of criticism about him in terms of not being, when he was a member of the NDP caucus, a team player. You get that from what you read, say Ed Broadbent or Alexa McDonough say. In terms of how he's regarded today, I mean, they're pretty honest about how it was unpleasant at times to be in caucus with him, right?
Yeah, there's some lingering tension in his relationships with some of his longtime caucus colleagues, with some of his former leaders, to be sure. There were some pretty strong disagreements on tactics.
Yeah.
throughout his career. I mean, I think the question of being a team player, I think the question of caucus solidarity, I think these are interesting questions, and I think that you can have a pretty valid viewpoint on both sides of the debate. You know, but at the end of the day, Robinson was more interested in telling what he believed to be true, more than he was interested in the political fortunes of the NDP. And I mean, personally, I think that I think that you kind of need both. I see the role for caucus solidarity, but at the same time, you need to have members with the ability to dissent from that without it causing, intense distress for a party. I don't know, maybe I'm dreaming in Technicolor.
what was very curious in your book is you talked to Robinson about some of these incidents, and there is a difference in how Broadbent and McDonough themselves remember certain situations, and a great disparity in how Robinson felt and how they felt.
Yeah, I think so. Actually, I said something like that to Ed Broadbent, and his answer was kind of funny. I didn't end up putting it in the book, but he said something like, well, it's probably my propensity to bury bad memories, so I only remember the good stuff. Yeah. I think that they were being a little bit diplomatic. A former leader has maybe more of a duty to do so. From what I could tell from my research, from what I could tell from other people, there were some pretty significant disagreements, and I think at the time that Mr. Broadbent and Ms. McDonough did feel a great deal of stress in their relationships with Sven. That said, I also do think Sven took the disagreements harder than they did.
I see, yeah. But the relationship with Jack Layton, though, when Layton became leader, that was a little bit better, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think it's partly because Sven, I think, saw himself as more part of the team as opposed to on the outside looking in. Yeah. He had been one of only two caucus members to support Layton for leadership. So I think he just sort of felt more part of the inner circle.
Yeah, there's something in the Brad Levine book on Layton that came out this season about the relationship between Layton and Robinson. That Layton knew how to placate seems to be the wrong word, but that Robinson in caucus would often during the Broadbent and McDonough years get quite passionate about things and perhaps storm out in a snit over something. But Layton would say, make him go back and apologize, which is something that Broadbent and McDonough weren't able to get him to do.
Well, I mean, Layton has a pretty legendary reputation as someone who built bridges. He was somebody who could get pretty diverse people to come together on something. So the fact that he was able to manage what was more of a tactical disagreement usually than a political one isn't all that surprising to me.
Now, Robinson lives in Switzerland today, is that right?
That's right.
And his job, that's nonpartisan, right?
Yeah, I mean, he has to work directly with parliamentarians from different countries of different political parties. And for example, he has to work with the Canadian government, which is led by the Conservative Party, not by the NDP. So that's just an example of how it works, right? So he has to correspond with people across the political spectrum, across the country. And so, yeah, absolutely, it's a nonpartisan job. It's an advocacy job, right? He's working to try and encourage governments to contribute to the fight against AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria.
As an analyst, do you see the NDP as a different party today than it was, say, 10 years ago when he was last there? I mean, is the culture different, do you think?
Well, that's a tough question to answer, in part because it's slightly beyond the scope of the book.
Well, did you think he'd be comfortable, say, if he was still an MP in sort of the NDP of today, of Mr. Mulcair, say?
I think it's really hard to compare. Politics 10 years down the road is probably going to look really different than it does now, and similarly, of course, today looks very different than 10 years ago. I think that Sven would be Sven. I think we've seen enough examples of that over the course of his career. I also think that some of the tools that motivate people today are the same that that motivated people then. You need to be a good communicator in politics now, just like you did before. He is that. You need to know how to generate a soundbite, manage your media profile. These are all the same. These have the same value today as they always did. So I think that he'd have all the same tools at his disposal in that sense.
In terms of regrets, he's quite honest in the book that one of them was his conduct during the leadership race, the NDP leadership race of 1995. For to remind people of what happened there, he went into the leadership race to replace Audrey McLaughlin with a lot of delegates in tow. He led on the first ballot. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, and
that's right.
And before the second ballot, he throws his support to McDonough, who I guess she was third at the time. Is that right?
She was second at the time.
She placed second, I guess. Okay.
She at the end of the first ballot, he led, followed by Ms. McDonough, followed by Lorne Nystrom. Mm. Now, what he expected, and what I think everyone at the time expected, was that Mr. Nystrom's sort of more centrist supporters would have preferred McDonough to Robinson. They would have supported her on the second ballot, and she would have won anyway. And so what Robinson was trying to do was, as a show of unity, say, well, then, you know, I'll get behind her as well. And that was a deeply misinterpreted maneuver. It did not result in the unity that he'd sought, and instead, I think, was a bone of contention between him and Ms. McDonough for years.
As well as his supporters, too. They were quite pissed off by it, weren't they?
That's right. And his supporters, I mean, they have invested blood, sweat, and tears in a leadership race, and leadership races are long. It's a lot of work, and they wanted to be rewarded with a chance to continue voting for him up until the end. And I think they felt a little bit cheated. They felt that this was sort of, I don't know, backroom politics, not the sort of upfront and you know, straightforward dealing that they admired in him. So it was a maneuver that failed on both counts, yeah, and he deeply regrets it.
Yeah, and from talking to Alexa McDonough, she feels that it sort of stole her thunder, that here she was winning the leadership of the New Democratic Party, or getting it, and yet it was all about Sven.
Well, she didn't say that to me, but that's what numerous other people close to her said to me. What she said was that, you know, it was, I don't remember her exact words, but it was something like that was, you know, Sven being Sven or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a little bit different, a little bit outrageous, but, you know, that's what he was like sometimes. But from what other people have told me, it was not something that she liked, and that it kind of took away, you know, a legitimate achievement, that is, you know, winning the leadership of the NDP, and you know, she had to defend the legitimacy of her win on the first day, which is, you know, not the position that she would have wanted to be in, for sure.
Yeah, do you get the sense that he did what he did because he didn't want to lose?
No. I asked him something similar, and he almost seemed a little bit taken aback or baffled by it. Losing doesn't seem to have really been the issue. I mean, he wanted to win,
yeah.
But no, I don't think it was losing.
I mean,
I think it was a genuine, if misguided, attempt to bring unity to the party, and perhaps rebrand him to a certain extent as a team player for perhaps a future leadership run, maybe. But I think that's the most self-serving thing that could be said about it. I don't think it was about trying to avoid losing.
Yeah. But he did lose in 2006 when he tried to make a comeback, I guess, in political life, when he ran in Vancouver Centre. He knew he was going to lose that race, right?
Well, he knew as election day approached. He thought he had a shot when he went for the nomination. He wouldn't have gone for the nomination had he known at that time that that he was going to lose. In fact, I think looking back, he probably regrets having run at all. But when he went for the nomination, he'd commissioned a poll that showed that he was behind, but you know, within the margin of error. So I think he genuinely believed he had a shot if he had a great campaign, if the NDP's popularity continued to rise, which it did, but that didn't translate into more votes for him in Vancouver Centre, and so he lost.
Another thing that's interesting to think about, say, 10 years after the fact, does he regret resigning after the ring incident? I mean, nowadays, I'm thinking. I mean, there's a certain mayor in this country who hasn't resigned over worse. I'm trying to think now. If the ring incident had happened today, would he have resigned? I mean, I'm trying to think now if that could have happened and he could have stayed on.
I think it would have been difficult for him
to stay on. You mean?
Yeah, I don't think he would have wanted to do that. I don't think that that current examples in municipal politics would really have been much comfort to him. I don't think that's the example that he would have wanted to follow. I think that what happened was I mean, from a political standpoint, damaging enough that he had to resign. That said, the real issue, I think, is that it was the right thing to do from the perspective of his personal health.
Yeah.
That was the reason that he started taking care of himself. And, you know, in the end, who knows what would have happened had he continued working at the pace that he was working at, continued to live under the level of stress that he was living. You know, I mean, I think his political fortunes are really a secondary question at this point.
Mm-hmm.
For the good of his health, he had to step down. He had to learn to start doing things differently, to live differently. And he does now, and he's, you know, I think a healthier person.
Yeah, in the course of, I mean, if you look at the life, it was more than, say, just stealing a ring. There were issues with his mental health that needed to be addressed that time, right?
Yeah, I mean, when the ring theft happened, I remember feeling just so baffled. It was like, you know, it was like something out of outer space. It just didn't make any sense. And over the course of researching this book, I began to feel differently. It began to feel more like inevitable.
Yeah.
That the way he was living his life, the constant pressure, the frantic work pace, always putting, you know, himself last, sooner or later that was going to catch up to him. And whether it was, you know, then or 6 months earlier or later, whether it was stealing a ring or whether it was doing something else, something was going to snap, something was going to crack. And so, yeah, that feeling of bewilderment at how this happened was replaced for me with a sort of a sense of, it was inevitable that something was going to happen, unless he started to learn to take care of himself better. And in the end, you know, it was this that spurred him to do that.
There's some marvelous writing in this book, as I've already said, but you also bring us in this book some marvelous tidbits, pieces of political history even, and the whole thing about a certain cabinet minister in the Liberal government of 1984 and with regards to the creation of CSIS, for example, is a great piece of history there. And you reveal, for the first time, some the relationship of Robinson, the friendship, I should say, with Brian Mulroney, which was obviously warm from both sides, right?
Yeah, and that's something that that I don't think either men during their political career would have been anxious to broadcast, and probably would surprise people. But yeah, they had a you know, a warm personal relationship, as you say, and that did translate, I think, into a more productive work relationship in the House of Commons. I felt that, you know, obviously they were pretty different in terms of their political ideologies, but Robinson always got the opportunity to say his piece in the House of Commons in those days, and you know, was able to have an impact, although he was a, you know, a member of a third party. I trace in the book occasions where he genuinely impacted public policy. I mean, which is something that that Brian Mulroney, when I talked to, he acknowledged readily.
Yeah, you also reveal in the book an aspect of Mr. Mulroney's family life that we hadn't read elsewhere. I mean, I checked his memoirs to see if he wrote anything about his brother. There's nothing in there like what you reveal in this book.
Yeah, that was certainly a big surprise to me. It was it's a very moving moment. I'm not sure if I should describe it or let people discover it for themselves in the book. What do you think?
Yeah, no, people should pick it up because I think it reveals a great deal about Mulroney himself, who surprisingly in recent years has I guess almost rehabilitated himself, not quite, but certainly it's in the last week or so with the death of Mandela, for example, he's come off pretty good. And the speech that he gives his caucus, which you excerpt in your book here, I think says something about the character of the person beyond, say, the traditional partisan stuff that we're used to about him.
Yeah, well, he was a skilled politician. I mean, certainly he left a divisive legacy. There are people who you know, revile him and others who revere him, but he was a skilled politician, and he had some attitudes on gay rights that come from, you know, come from a genuine place, come from a genuine understanding of the harm of and the illogic, I suppose, of discrimination. And I certainly know the piece in the passage in the book that you're referring to, and I hope people find that as illuminating as you did.
Yeah, as I've also told you, this is stylistically a very well written book, and it sounds like I'm patronizing it, but I'm not. Will you write again? Because it's a pretty good book.
Thanks, I really appreciate that. That's it's a really gratifying compliment, and I certainly hope to do more. This was a book I really felt needed writing, mm-hmm. and I would love to write another book that I feel the same way about, that I feel that it's a story that should be told, and so I'm just waiting for that idea at the moment.
Well, what you've done with this book, it's a highly engaging book, and also a necessary piece of history, so congratulations on writing it, and continued good luck with it, Graham.
Well, thanks, I really appreciate it.
The book is called Sven Robinson, A Life in Politics. It's from New Star Books. It's author Graham Truelove. Join me on the line from Ottawa in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.